This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's a virtuous cycle in that the more the people use it, the more the prices come down, the more cost competitive they are.
What does it look like when a dirty industry goes clean? And can an ethical company be a profitable one? Today on Sea Change Radio, we talk to two people who work in very different industries, dairy processing and capitalism. Our first guest is Bree Johnson from the Strauss Family Organic Creamery, who talks about practices that make milk production a more sustainable, less polluting, and cleaner enterprise. Then we speak with Tom Blaisdell of DCM Partners about clean technology, where the concept of efficiency links the strange bedfellows of investment capitalism and sustainability. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Bree Johnson. She's a sustainability and communications manager at Strauss Family Creamery, based in Marshall, California. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, Bree.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me here today.
Tell us a little bit about the history of Strauss Family Creamery.
Well, the creamery was founded in 1994 by Albert Strauss, and he had grown up on his parents' dairy in Marshall, California. And his parents, Bill and Ellen Strauss, started that dairy in 1941. And they had always been very into environmental stewardship and, you know, taking care of the land. And I don't think organic was very far from what they were ever practicing. Albert went off to college at Cal Poly and got a degree in dairy science, came back, started managing the dairy, running it with his father. And around 1990, someone approached him and wanted to make organic ice cream. And at that time, there wasn't any organic dairies on the West Coast. I mean, there weren't very many organic dairies in the U.S., period. And so in 1993, he started the conversion to organic of his dairy, and it was complete in 1994.
What's the difference between a creamery and a dairy?
So the dairy is where the cows are and where the cows get milked. And two times a day, the milk gets taken to the creamery where it's processed and it's made into different products.
The dairy is milking the cows. The creamery is processing the milk.
Mm-hmm. The creamery is the plants, the manufacturing plants.
So it's kind of like a vineyard versus a winery.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about when the two dairy worlds diverged from the industrial farming and the non-sustainable or less sustainable practices in mass-produced milk and smaller farms that are producing organic products like Strauss Family Creamery.
Well, I think the advent of the organic dairies started taking off in the early 90s. I think before that, I mean, starting with the industrialization of agriculture, which started happening, you know, as early back as the 50s and the 60s, I think, is when it really took off with petrochemicals and fertilizers being manufactured for the war. Agriculture became a secondary place to use those, and they came up with all these new products. And things just grew on a bigger and bigger scale as far as agriculture went, and dairy started growing in size, and they got bigger and bigger.
Just what are consumers getting when they buy organic milk?
So when consumers are buying organic milk, they're getting milk that was produced according to very strict standards. No pesticides were used on the land. No pesticides were used on the food that is grown for the cows. No hormones are used. No antibiotics are used. And the cows have to be given adequate access to pasture and a really healthy, balanced diet. And all those things lead to treating the land in a very controlled and sustained way, because you protect for things like erosion and water and contamination of surrounding water bodies. That's kind of interesting. If we look at the Strauss dairy, the original dairy where Albert grew up and that kind of started the whole thing.
In Marshall.
It's right on the Tomales Bay. So they had been collecting their manure for years, since the 50s, because the very pristine, beautiful body of water is right there. And, you know, sometimes with an inland air, you might not be able to see your effects that great, but when you're so close to a body of water, you know, you protect it, you can see it. And so they had been diverting their manure into ponds. And then in the 80s, Albert heard of methane digesters and wanted to start one himself. And he started it, and he'd run out of funding, and he'd started it again. And finally, by 2004, he had completed the methane digester, which converts manure from the cows into electricity. And it's kind of neat. It powers the car that he drives.
So how exactly do these methane digesters work?
So there's methane gas that arises from the manure, and it is anaerobically digested. Little bacteria eat it. It produces all the electricity that is used on the farm. It heats all the hot water that's used to wash everything. And it saves the farm about $40,000 a year in costs. And now the regulations have been changed so that any excess power that's created can be sold back to the grid. And, you know, you can become essentially a small-scale energy producer. And for small farmers, having another source of income like that is really a nice thing to have. And sustainability is three dimensions. It's people, planet, and profit. And profit's a big part of that. I mean, you can't do the other things if you're not sustaining yourself economically. So things like that, which can help the environment by, you know, you're preventing, methane is a really harmful gas that contributes to global warming. By capturing it and putting it in a pond and digesting it and turning it into electricity, you're doing that, but you're also preventing that gas from going into the atmosphere where it can contribute to climate change.
So is organic milk worth the extra money for consumers? And does it make sense for dairy farmers to be producing more organic milk?
In the conventional market, the way the pricing structures are for conventional and organic milk are different. And so it is really worth a farmer's time to convert to organic in the dairy industry because they get paid a higher price for their milk. It works out economically. And I think that's the beauty of Strauss and, you know, the other dairies is that it is economically viable. It is profitable.
What's the value proposition of organic milk versus non-organic milk?
Well, the value proposition is you know that your milk was produced in conformance with organic standards and that the cows have been treated right. They've been fed good food. I mean, what the cows eat goes into their milk, essentially. And if you want to be putting good milk into your body, then you want the cows to be treated right, to be healthy, and to be eating good food. And we have the choice to vote with our dollar and, you know, support the practices that we might support. And I know that's why a lot of customers buy our milk. We have a Facebook page, and today we asked on Facebook, why do you buy organic? And people answered. They said, well, I want to vote with my dollar. I want to have good quality, nutritious food, and
willing to pay a premium for it.
They will pay a premium for it because it's worth it to them. And plus, people say it tastes better.
All right, so let's talk about packaging then, because I know this, that Strauss has really set itself apart from when I go to Safeway. I don't have the choice between different packages, but you have your bottles, which you pay, I think, $1.50 deposit when you're purchasing that, and you can get that back. And that's sustainable, but it also is cost effective. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about how that program was initiated and what it means for them?
Well, I think it was initiated by Albert because he just liked glass bottles better. He thought the milk tasted better from them. We go back to taste and quality. That was first and foremost. And the second part was it created less waste. You're right. The consumers pay $1.50 deposit for their bottle. And then when we're done with it, they bring it back. And the bottles get reused an average of 6 to 8 times. So we know that, you know, for every bottle that's reused, that's a plastic container not having to be created and used. And we wash them in the facility when we get them back, and they go back on the line.
How does that contrast in terms of carbon footprint, do you think?
Well, we haven't done a life cycle analysis of glass versus cardboard, and we haven't seen a good one because if you're going to really look at the carbon footprint, you need to know how far that glass milk bottle is traveling and the emissions created during that transport.
It's also heavier, right?
It is also heavier.
And there's water.
There's water to wash it. But the most where you get your largest percentage of greenhouse emissions in a packaging product is in the creation of it. So if you're reusing it 6 to 8 times, that 6 to 8 times something else hasn't had to have been created.
Even if it's glass, cardboard, whatever,
exactly.
The energy that goes into creating any of these finished materials is the big piece of the carbon puzzle, so to speak, right?
Exactly. And the environmental philosophy, you heard the 3 R's, reduce, reuse, recycle. So you want to reduce the amount of materials that are needed to create it in the first place, reuse it where possible, and then recycle at the end.
So composting it versus reusing it may be a wash, and it's kind of, that shouldn't really go into the issue as much as the production of the initial product.
That's what the experts have indicated.
Well, Bree Johnson, the Sustainability and Communications Manager at Strauss Family Creamery, really appreciate you being my guest here on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It was great to be here.
Well, I woke up this morning, looked out door. I could tell my milk cow, I could tell by the way she lows. If you see my milk cow, please drive her on home. 'Cause I ain't had no milk and butter, woo, since my cow's been gone.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
So our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Tom Blaisdell. He is a general partner at DCM, an early startup venture capital firm focusing on technology. Tom's expertise is in software and clean technology, also known as clean tech. Tom has served as a marketing executive for Intuit. He was also an entrepreneur whose startups include Fatbrain and Encanto. Tom, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Glad to be here.
First, tell us a little bit about DCM, your mission, and why clean tech, and some of your roster of companies that you've invested in.
Sure. DCM is an early stage venture capital company, as you mentioned. We have about $2 billion under management that we invest in early stage technology startups to help them go from being as early as, the prototypical two guys in a garage to some later stage companies, but eventually with the objective of building them into billion-dollar enterprises. That's the model that we're working on. As a venture capital firm, we tend to focus, if you think of R&D, research and development, a venture capital firm is going to tend to invest in the development stage, less so the research phase. Research usually gets done with government grants. It gets done in big corporations like IBM and Cisco and places like that. We focus on companies that are past the invention stage, but now are in the development phase of how do we take this development to market and grow it into a big, successful, profitable organization. Our platform is built on, we have offices in Menlo Park, California, Beijing, China, and Tokyo, Japan. We do direct investments in all three of those geographies, as well as other locations in the world, but primarily in those three geographies. And then we spend a lot of time working on cross-border business development for the companies that we're working with. So for example, if we were to invest in a company here in the U.S., we would help them take their products and services and organization into China, for example, to reach new markets or to source manufacturing capacity in another location. Or, for example, to work with, if you're a semiconductor chip company, you might want to work with the customers, the consumer electronic companies in Japan would be able to make those introductions, et cetera.
Tom, what's the difference between what venture capitalists do and what a private equity firm does?
Venture capital and PE can seem like a real black box to a lot of folks from the outside. It certainly did to me before I became involved in it personally. Venture capital and private equity are actually, a lot of people put those in the same box. They're actually quite different. private equity tends to focus on making investments into sort of existing larger companies, perhaps that are already profitable, and looking for ways to make them more profitable, whether that's restructuring the workforce or restructuring the financing, adding debt, et cetera. Venture capital is very much focused on company creation, getting in at the start when nothing exists or very little exists, maybe just an idea, maybe just an invention, maybe just a small team with an idea, and then helping that team and take that idea or that invention and grow it into a company. And there's just so many things that have to happen to go from a team with an idea or a team with an invention and build that into a company.
So the reason somebody would go to a venture capital firm rather than a bank for their loan is?
Is because we're going to help them build their company day in, day out in a very hands-on way. And normally, we tend to be people that have already done that ourselves. We tend to be ex-entrepreneurs. Everyone on our team here at DCM has had some hand in growing small startups into large organizations. I mean, when I was at fatbrain.com, I started working with the two founders there when it literally was two guys and a dog in the garage. And at the end of the day, they were a public company on NASDAQ and they got bought by barnesandnoble.com. So there's a lot of steps in between those two places. And venture capital is fundamentally, in that sense, about job creation in that we're building those organizations. So how can that help someone in the clean tech space? There's a lot of activities that can happen in clean tech, only a very small subset, as in any area of business, is going to be appropriate for venture capital. We tend to be good at companies that need to scale quickly to take advantage of technology advantages.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the clean tech investments that your firm's made?
Sure. About 10 to 15% of our investments probably go into things that could be classified as clean tech. And it's a natural extension of our technology investments in general. Just to give some examples right off the bat, Abound Solar is a solar panel manufacturer. It uses a cadmium telluride technology, very similar to what First Solar uses, although we have a very different process for manufacturing it. BridgeLux would be another example. They're in the LED lighting space, which is very energy efficient lighting fixtures, which is fundamentally what a lot of people don't know is LEDs are semiconductors. So if you're a technology investor and you invest in people that make silicon chips for computers, an LED for lighting is made with an extremely similar process. BridgeLux is another example. Myox, which I believe you had Carlos Perea on your show recently, is the CEO of Myox, which is in the water disinfection space, but using a very advanced technology that was developed at Los Alamos Labs in New Mexico. And one final example would be SandForce, which is a company that makes, again, semiconductor chips. In this case, controller chips for solid-state storage, which allows solid-state storage to provide the same level of reliability in storage as traditional rotating media storage, or what you think of as a disk drive.
So this category of clean tech is much wider than a lot of people may assume. It doesn't just include solar panel makers or advanced biofuel makers. It also includes efficiency.
Absolutely correct. When we made the SandForce investment, we didn't even think of it as a clean tech investment. We just thought of it as a chip investment where we were going to deliver a very compelling ROI, a return on investment to our customers. But what became clear as we were developing that chip was, yes, people were worried about the ROI and saving the money. They were also worried about reducing their carbon footprint of their data centers. And they were also worried just about the absolute supply of power. Where could they get a reliable supply of power? If you think about, you know, Apple or Google or Yahoo going out to set up their next data center, they're scouring, you know, not only the US but the globe to find cheap, reliable sources of power for those data centers. If we can reduce the necessity of power in those data centers by 70 to 90%, that opens up a lot more opportunities to them. And again, at the same time, providing a real carbon footprint benefit. It's a virtuous cycle in that the more the people use it, the more the prices come down, the more cost competitive they are, and the better that is for everybody. And solar, we're certainly seeing that in solar, where leaders like First Solar are really driving down that price by economies of scale, by this manufacturing experience curve. That allows people like Abound Solar to come along and join the experience curve at that point and keep driving prices down even further.
Seems like solar is a little different than the efficiency market in terms of the way that traditionally contractors have bid on projects for a home has been coming in at the lowest price, which with solar, it's not as stark a contrast. But if you're a homeowner looking at putting in new wiring to your home, you're going to usually not think about how insulated that wiring is and how efficient it may be, and it actually may save you in the long run to go with a more expensive bid. But solar, it's a little more of a transparent purchase at this point.
That's
right?
Exactly right. Now, two things to that. One, I think there's more and more green builders out there. So you can get contractors that are actually going to think about all those more invisible decisions about, you know, what kind of wiring are you putting in, what kind of water system are you putting in, and decisions like that. But you're right, everything's very transparent in solar because all the costs are right there in front of you. Now, this is where innovation happens on lots of different levels at the same time, because there's financial innovation that happens around solar as well, which is the big disadvantage to solar in the past has been you got to come up with this big lump sum of cash up front to install the system, and then you don't get it back over a long period of time. There's more and more lease programs out there or mortgage type programs, et cetera, where they will, you know, some third party financing group will pay for the installation on your house, and then they get paid first out of the savings. So it's basically zero cost to you up front, but you start to see the savings right away. But a lot of the savings go to pay off that lease, and then once it's paid off, of course, all the benefits accrue to you after that. That's going to reduce that barrier to people taking that first step to installing a solar system. One thing that as I was researching solar for my own house, you know, that I would throw out for people just to keep in the back of their mind as well, was one of the issues when they came out to look at my house was, well, you only have 5 years left on this roof. So if we install this now, 5 years from now, you're going to have to remove the whole solar system, get a new roof put on, and then, you know, put the solar system back on, and that's going to increase the costs and make the payoff not look as good as well. Two solutions to that. One is you can actually have just the parts where you're going to cover with solar, you can have re-roofed, you know, when you get the solar installed, so it'll last longer. And the other thing that I'd encourage your listeners to think about is, if you're getting a new roof, that's the time to be thinking, hey, I should be thinking about solar here at the same time.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest today is Tom Blaisdell, general partner at DCM, a early stage venture capital firm in Menlo Park, California. Tom, you were talking about the crossover point with a lot of these companies that you invest in. Where do you see the sweet spots for companies finding a crossover point where they actually grow but don't ship a lot of their jobs overseas?
Well, I think technology can be a big driver of that. The value of the IP, that the more that there's intellectual property value embedded or technology value embedded in the product rather than human labor value, the more sense it actually makes to do it locally. So for example, if the labor content of cost, if 90% of the cost of making something is labor, it's going to make sense to move that to a place where labor is far cheaper than it is in the U.S. If 7% of the cost of making something is in the labor, then it's maximizing the rest of things. Maybe it's shipping and distribution. Maybe it's materials. Maybe it's all those other things.
Give me an example of a company that you're thinking of.
So, for example, Abound does all of their manufacturing in Longmont, Colorado right now. Every panel they produce is produced in Longmont, Colorado right now. With the latest announcement that President Obama made in one of his weekly video speeches about loan guarantees that were extended to a Bendigo Solar as well as a Bound Solar. They mentioned the fact that the next site located for a Bound is in Tipton, Indiana. I think that makes sense to the extent that the technology is developed here. We want to protect the IP by keeping it in the United States. And also, that will be more and more important to us as our customers are in the United States as well. Now, if our customers are in Europe, it may make sense at some point to have manufacturing in Europe just because it's a shipping cost issue, right? And to the extent that we may have customers in Asia, then that can make sense as well. But to the extent that we can build up a local market for the solar panels that are created, and to the extent that we want to protect the intellectual property embedded in the processes to make those solar panels, it makes sense to have that manufacturing in the United States. That's why it's so important for us to develop that intellectual property in the United States. That's why the research and development budgets are so important. The ARPA-E program is so important. You know, venture capitalists being able to work with these companies to develop the companies in the United States are so important as well.
But I'm not quite sure I follow you in terms of the labor ratios, because as this company, Abound Solar, starts to grow, they're going to have to make more and more of these panels. And so there's going to be more hands involved in that actual process of manufacturing. And yes, this money from the government is a great way to catalyze that growth, but eventually it's just a subsidized industry if it continues. If it's, you know, 10 years down the road, we're still looking at government subsidies needed to keep those jobs in the U.S. Because once Abound Solar gets to a certain scale, it may make sense for them, just like Walmart, to ship in their Chinese products, or Dell to start having their customer service coming out of Malaysia, the Philippines, or India. I mean, I don't think necessarily that U.S. jobs are any better than European jobs or Asian jobs, but it's not only for the financial well-being of those countries, but also if we look at the carbon footprints of having to ship things all around the world all the time.
Absolutely. And I think in this case in particular, shipping's is a big deal, right? I mean, if you're making semiconductor chips, you know, very, very high value to weight ratio, like high value, low weight, you can make them anywhere and ship them anywhere. Solar panels are pretty big and heavy. So to the extent that we have a domestic market for consumption of those panels, more of those jobs will stay in the United States. But there's also the issue of what kind of jobs are they? They, at Abound, for example, a lot of those jobs will tend to be more high-skilled jobs. And in particular, the advantage of the process that we've created is in the semiconductor steps. When you think about it, and this gets back to why are we even investing in this area, a solar panel is essentially a really, really big semiconductor. I mean, it's semiconductor materials put down with semiconductor processes to take photons from the sun and change them into electrical energy. And it's a 2-foot by 4-foot semiconductor is what a solar panel is. The machines that are made to carry out those process steps are highly advanced and have a lot of intellectual property embedded in them. And as a result, we would want to have those processes primarily stay in the United States, where there's very good protection of intellectual property, right? But to the point of whether jobs will be shipped into other areas, I think that's going to be driven a lot by where the consumption of the end product is.
Particularly in these heavier products like solar panels.
Especially in the higher, you know, weight to value part of the regime as well. But you could also look at, you know, do the high value added, high skilled, high intellectual property steps of the process here in the U.S. and then ship it over for finishing in the country where it's actually going to be installed, where now you add the second piece of glass or the piece of molding or brackets that go around the side, so you don't have to ship those over, you know, those heavy parts overseas.
Tom Blaisdell, a general partner at DCM, thanks so much for being with us on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Freddie Hubbard, Terrence Blanchard, and Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Solar Home Specialists and Invisible Structures, a porous paving company. Go to Sungevity.com and InvisibleStructures.com to learn more. Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.